Folks, hi there, this is Elvin Shamroth. Let me start by offering my profuse apologies for my late entry. With time zone changes, I slipped up and I apologize. This really virtually never ever happens, and I certainly trust it will not happen again this year. So please forgive me. Let's get straight on with it. This is the second teleconference of this year, and I was hoping, like we typically do have, we get one or two, and as the year goes by, three or four people who request to be on the hot seat and who submit questions regarding concerns they have on their cases typically, or how to defend, present a particular issue. And because this is the beginning of the season, there's a hesitancy amongst you folks to volunteer. Consequently, I don't have any volunteers. And folks, I have to tell you, if I don't get volunteers, really the quality of this whole interaction diminishes. And to get the maximum benefit out of this, it's far, far preferred if we can get people who want to volunteer, submit questions. And listen, those of you who joined us 2 weeks ago, you saw I'm a pretty decent guy. I'm not going to belittle anyone, insult anyone. Also, you always remain anonymous. So even if I were to ask you something which you didn't know the answer to, no one would know who you were, because I've never mentioned a last name, and you always remain anonymous. So I plead with you folks, please, for the next time around, please submit questions, because if we don't, I'm going to spread this out from every 2 weeks. I'll spread it out to every 3 and every 4 weeks. And it's really a pity. It really is. So I really want to encourage, implore you folks, volunteer. It's really good for you folks. Given the fact that there's no one that submitted any questions in anticipation of today's teleseminar, I am going to open it up, and I think I did this 2 weeks ago. I'm going to unmute everyone in a moment, and I'm going to invite you folks to offer up any questions that you may have. All I would do before I unmute everyone is ask you please to make sure that you're in a room where there's no background noise. Otherwise, there'll be so much ruckus in the background, we just won't be able to conduct this. So please, please go ahead and make sure there's no noise in the background. I'm also going to ask you folks to just shout out your first name if you've got any questions. Shout out your first name, and I'll acknowledge, and then we can go ahead and you can present your question. We'll see what transpires. So I'm going to open up the teleseminar now. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Okay. So I'm going to ask for volunteers, folks. Yes. Yes, Karina.
Before you start, the next teleseminar is March 23rd.
March 23rd. Okay. Thank you so much. All of you heard all that, right? March 23rd, which is 2 weeks from today. So, excellent. Very good. Okay, thank you. Thank you. All right, by the way, you folks just heard Karina. Let me take this opportunity to share with you that the people that you will be speaking with as you interact with our office is number one, Karina, number two, Beth, and number three, Marla. And I want to tell you, they are absolutely dedicated to your success. They will do whatever they can to help you. They're available Mondays through Fridays. Sunday, we're also open. And so please, they really want all of you folks to pass, as do all our faculty, myself included. So just be aware they're there for you folks. All right, so I'm going to wait and ask for anyone who has a question. I don't care how insignificant or seemingly inconsequential it is. Please shout out your name, and we'll go. I'll acknowledge, and we'll go ahead. Any volunteers? Come on, come on, folks. If no one volunteers, this is going to be a very short teleseminar. I want someone to volunteer. Someone shout out their name, and let's have a conversation. Mm-hmm. folks.
My name is Emma. I have a question.
Yes, hi. The name is, I didn't quite get the name.
Emma,
thank you so much for volunteering. I really appreciate it. And I'm telling you, everyone else listening in does too. Go ahead. What's your question?
It is kind of insignificant, but I had a question about cases for ultrasound. Is that something I read made it, and I'm trying to look through it, but I can't find where I was seeing it, but no one was talking, so I decided to jump in. Are we supposed to be counting the number of ultrasounds we're doing?
Are you talking about, firstly, on OB, and are you talking about patients in – there's a section in the office, ultrasound, a category ultrasound.
Right.
What specifically are you referring to when you talk about counting ultrasounds?
Sorry, the ultrasound is a category, and something I read made me think that maybe I was supposed to be counting the number of ultrasounds.
No.
This
is a good question. Let's talk about ultrasounds and the exam. And firstly, specifically on answer your question, and unless they've very recently changed the regulations, You do not need to count ultrasounds. Number one, on the OB section, if there's an interesting finding on an ultrasound that you want to talk about, then by all means, put it down on paper. But if there's nothing of great interest, even though she may have had one or two ultrasounds, you don't need to mention it. It's up to you. Now, with respect to the office section, where there is a category called ultrasounds, here, like with all categories in the office section, it's different from OB and GYN, where you, to all intents and purposes, have to list every case. Midwife cases and normal vaginal deliveries are an exception. You don't need to do that. But on the office section, there are probably about 40 different categories in the office section, maybe more. And I get every now and then questions that relate to this issue, and I'm sure there are some of you listening in for which you're not sure about this, or you think you're sure, but you've got it wrong. You do not need to list patients in every category. In fact, many categories will have no patients in, they'll be empty. You can either list 0, 1, or 2 patients in any given category. And you've got to have a total of 40 for your office section. And the reason I'm very confident for this is they want to make sure that you've got a decent spread of pathology so that the examiner can pick on a multitude of different cases, and each one can generate a slightly different conversation. So when it comes to ultrasound, you know, I've reviewed literally hundreds of cases over the year. And in the ultrasound section, they are usually mundane issues, and people usually just put it down as a place filler. There's really nothing major going on in cases in that category. But the kind of things that you might want to put down, if you want to get a conversation going on how accurate is ultrasound when it comes to gestational age determination, and what are the differences between a first versus a second versus a third trimester ultrasound, then you might want to put down dating ultrasound 6 weeks and whatever else goes on there. And that will try and get a gestational dating criteria conversation going. If you want to get an aneuploidy screening conversation going, which can happen in the OB side and also possibly in the office side, then put down mid-second trimester 2019 week, whatever it is, ultrasound, and say aneuploidy screening ultrasound. And that way you can try and generate that aneuploidy conversation. Outside of those two broad categories, it's really a very outside of those two clinical scenarios, it's pretty much a boring category. I'll just share that with you. Very difficult to make it exciting. And I want to caution you against trying to make it too exciting. You may have a rare congenital anomaly that was picked up on ultrasound. It's probably not a good case to put down because, number one, it might be so rare that even the examiner hasn't even heard about it, number one. Number two, it's not really expected that a candidate at the general board level should be, on average, be able to talk about this. Yes, you having managed this patient should be able to say something about it. But based on the fact that you just simply managed her, you probably already know more than the examiner. So these are not likely to generate significant discussions. That's the point I'm trying to make. Cases outside of those two examples that I gave you are probably not going to generate significant discussions. You might want to get one, for example, add a third category, cervical length screening. That might be another conversation that you might want to get. But just be cautious of putting cases in the ultrasound category. I'm not saying don't do it, but just as you think about it, try and determine what kind of conversation might be generated as a consequence of you putting that case down. So, Emma, I've been a little long-winded. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Anything else on your end?
I've heard two types of advice about caseless contraction in general. One is
yes.
Put some, like, interesting things in it so that they – you know, they have something to talk
to
you
about. Yeah, some people say to sanitize the case list, and others say, no, put some interesting stuff down, some complications. Is that what you were going to say?
Yeah.
So I'm very familiar with this argument. What I'm going to share with you folks, I feel very strongly about. And you've got to hear the whole conversation here. And I strongly counsel against sanitizing your case list, getting rid of all the complications, getting rid of all the difficult cases, trying to make it as easy as possible for yourself. Why do I say this? Number one, it's virtually unheard of that any OBGYN in a year of practice will not experience complications and problems. So number one, it's expected. Number two, if you have no complications, no interesting issues on your case list, what's the examiner going to ask you? Tell me about preterm labor, normal labor, progress in labor, calculation of adequate contractions. What, you know, it's such mundane stuff, and they're not going to really ask you much at that simple level. They, you know, that's a medical school level. They're going to ask you a little bit more. So if that's all they can glean from your case list because it's been sanitized, they're going to, after a very short period of time, stop asking you questions based off of your case list. And now they will ask you questions just off the top of their head, just to spice it up a little bit, make it more real and realistic. And if that happens, you've done yourself a disservice, because now you've lost the examiner's attachment to your case list. And they can ask you anything. There's no ways you can potentially predict the questions that are going to come at you during that 30 minutes, which are dedicated to the case list. 30 minutes of each hour, one for OB, one for G1, and 1 hour for office. 30 minutes, 50%, is dedicated to the case list. So if you're in OB, for example, and you have got nothing really of tremendous interest to spark the examiner's curiosity, that after 5 minutes, they're going to leave your case list and ask you questions that are more exam relevant. And now you've lost the ability to predict the questions. That's if you make it if you sanitize the list. Now, I'm not saying you should write a case list where every case has a complication and a problem, because that, you know, becomes problematic. If every C-section is a postpartum hemorrhage, that's a problem. You know, you might be doing things incorrectly. So I'm not saying you should go 180 degrees in the opposite direction. But what I am saying is you need to look at your case list. And I like choosing OB because there's so much variety. But you've, on average, got about 40, let's take GYN for this example. You've got 40, 45 on average cases on your GYN list. It's probably typical that you'll have 2, 3, or 4 complications on that list. And that's okay. In fact, not only is it okay, but it's desired. If you have no complications on your GYN list, it may lend the examiner to think, at least on a subconscious level, that you're not sufficiently aggressive if you've got no complications. So I go so far as to say, if you are one of the few that truly has no complications on your list in GYN, for example, in the preceding year, you need to try and, where possible, create complications. And I'm not suggesting you make it up out of thin air, and I'm not suggesting you should lie. Heaven forbid, you'll never hear me say that. But let me give you an example. There's always a case. I could make an argument that every case of hysteroscopy is a case where we're concerned about water intoxication. So if you've got a very bland case list and you want to spice it up a little bit, and you would love to have a conversation on water intoxication, prevention, diagnosis, and management, then what I would recommend you write is in the complications column of one of your hysteroscopies, concern for water intoxication. Was there intoxication? No. It got close, maybe. But there was one point where you were concerned. Once you've got that written down on paper, now the examiner's got something to sink his or her teeth into it. And they can ask you, why were you concerned? And once you've got that question, that invites the whole conversation on water intoxication. So I hope that makes sense to you. I feel strongly against sanitizing a case list. I'm excited where there are complications. And folks, I may have said this 2 weeks ago. I can't recall. If I did, it still warrants and is worth repeating. You folks universally have to readjust your thinking, have a paradigm shift in thinking. Instead of fearing and wanting to avoid complications, go out and make sure you have complications and be comfortable to talk about them, because that is really exam relevant stuff. So if you have complications, and we all do, and you're ready to talk about them, you can predict the questions, and you can score very highly in that section. So the bottom line, don't be fearful of your complications. Grow to love them and appreciate them. And I can't emphasize that enough, okay? Let me give you an example. Many of you listening in have Utron Perf, and you're thinking to yourself, oh my goodness, what on earth am I going to say that I perfed the uterus? First of all, there's no sin in perfing the uterus, and there's a beautiful list of about four or five questions that they would ask you if you've got a perf, and you can prepare for them very easily. But just to look at this issue from 35,000 feet, ask yourself the question, any of you have a perf, and those that you have who don't, you've still got 3.5 months, you never know what's around the corner. Ask yourself, you've got a perf. How many perforations do you think your examiner has had in his or her career? And I assure you, it's many, many more than what you've got on your case list. So don't feel bad. I don't want you to be blasé about it, but don't feel bad. Complications from the exam point of view, they're terrible in practice. None of us want them, but from the exam point of view, they are absolute gold, and grow to love them. And I can't emphasize that enough. You need to, folks, you need to all have a paradigm shift in thinking. Emma, does that make sense to you?
That makes sense. Thank you.
Any other questions on your end?
I don't think so.
Not at this time. Okay, if you have anything else, feel free to pipe up. I'll throw it open to anyone else. If anyone has a question or a concern, just shout out your first name. I'll acknowledge and we'll converse. Go ahead. Anyone?
Hi, my name is Emily. And I
Emily, hi there.
Hi, yes. I apologize, I don't have actually the information in front of me right now. But I was just curious. So one of the things that I was looking at was, you know, one of the categories for gyne is GI complications. And I was going to list, I had a patient that ended up getting an appendectomy because we found an abnormal finding at the time for hysterectomy, and it came up as cancer. Would that be something that would be considered a GI complication, or would that not really fit that category? I was just curious about that.
So let me answer another question beforehand, before I answer your direct question. Would you like to have a conversation on appendectomy at this point in time?
Probably.
Be honest.
Not. I think, yeah.
If you would have said yes, yeah. I would have thought you're not being honest. Yeah. None of us are really keen on it.
Uh-huh.
If I tell you that there are three, maybe four questions on appendectomy that I can share with you in 5 minutes that will enable you to engage in a 3-4 minute conversation on appendectomy, which at the end of that, the examiner will be blown over. Would you be comfortable to have an appendectomy conversation?
I mean, like putting out my list, I'd probably prepare for it. I was just curious.
Yeah.
That's
the point I'm making. This is exactly an example of what I was saying earlier. This is a complication. It's not your run-of-the-mill GYN surgery. So I would encourage you to put down the word appendectomy. And I'll come back to your question in a moment. And once that word is down, you've got to know the following questions. Describe McBurney's point. What are the basic steps of doing an appendectomy? And what is the role of appendectomy in the, or at least visualizing the appendix in a case of suspected ovarian mucosal? And there's one other question. Yes. at what age do we recommend, if we happen to be in the abdomen, prophylactic appendectomy? I think there was a committee opinion years ago, and I don't want to, please don't take this as dogma, but I believe the cutoff is something like 34. If you happen to be in the abdomen and the patient is under age 34, the risk-benefit ratio is in favor of doing an appendectomy. But if she's older, the risk-benefit ratio is against. So I've just given you four questions that if you mention the word appendectomy down on paper, you're liable to get those four questions. If you've worked out the answers before you walk in, do you realize you've captured 3 minutes out of 30 minutes dedicated to your case list in which you're scoring 100%. So that's the philosophy. Now, Emily, just share with me, you went in for a case of, what was the, just give me a little bit more background on the actual case.
Sure. So she was, I don't have the age right in front of me, but
yeah,
I
just
think,
off the top of your head, that's fine.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was about 40 years old. We were doing a total laparoscopic hysterectomy with bilateral salpingectomy due to abnormal uterine bleeding that was not improved with medical management. During the case, we just did our usual look around the abdomen and saw that her appendix had a very kind of bulbous end to it. So we called in the general surgeon who then performed the appendectomy, and the pathology report came back as an appendiceal cancer. But otherwise, the pathology was benign, just benign fibroids and adenomyosis for the uterus portion.
Okay, so you're raising another point that I just want to add to the conversation.
Sure.
Many of you are thinking, well, Emily did not do the appendectomy. The general surgeons did. Does that negate any possibility that Emily will be asked the questions that I mentioned before? And the answer is no. We are at the general board level. We're not expected to know how to do a colostomy. Okay, that's crazy. But the basic principles of an appendectomy, it's a fair question. We may not like it, but it's a fair question at the general board level. So once the word appendectomy is down on paper, no matter who did it, how it was done, where, when, under what circumstances, those big questions that I mentioned earlier become fair game. So I would take the following tack. I would say to myself, right now where Emily is writing up her case list, I would say, all right, I've got an interesting case of a surprise finding of an appendiceal mass, which turned out to be cancer after the patient had an appendectomy. Do I want this case to be on my list? And my immediate answer is yes. And I say, okay, if I want it to be on the list, what are the questions that are going to arise? And I've listed you some questions. There might be one or two that I haven't thought of. And then you make sure you can answer those questions. And now we get to the point, okay, I'm ready to roll on a discussion on appendectomy in the exam. How do I write it up on paper? And I think, Emily, am I correct? That's the question you were really asking. Am I right?
Yeah, yes, that's the question. I'm just curious where I would kind of put it in the case list, I guess.
I'll give you another bit of background info. When I review a case list, and I have to assume the examiner does the same thing, I look at every single case. I read every single word on every case on every list. That's what I'm paid to do. And you'd be amazed. Sometimes one word, one letter can cause immense grief in the exam, okay, just as an FYI. But getting back to this case, it's the easiest thing for an examiner to run down your case list and screen down the length of stay column and the complications column, because that's the quickest and easiest way to find the interesting cases. So if you want the examiner to see this, and I would encourage you to do that, then I would put the case down as a 40-year-old gravida 2 para 2, abnormal uterine bleeding, failure to respond to conservative therapy, laparoscopy, TAH and LS. In the complications column, I wouldn't even write. I'm debating whether or not to write the word incidental. It's up to you. It depends how bold you want to be verbally in the exam. So you might say incidental, or just simply appendiceal mass with appendectomy, semicolon, not colon as in larger or smaller colon, and then cancer. I think the word appendix needs to go down. If you can put the words appendix and appendectomy, that's twice. There's no way an examiner who sees that, and they will see it, there's no way they cannot ask you about this case. And that's how you get the conversation you're looking for in the exam. And the examiner feels they're in control because they're asking a totally legitimate question. And it is legitimate, but you're ahead of the game because you've written it down in such a way to make sure that it captures the examiner's eye and you're ready for the questions that are going to come. Does that make sense to you, Emily?
That does. Thank you so much.
All right. All right. I'll take one more quick question. Is there anyone else who wants to shout out their name? If there's anyone, go ahead.
Hi, it's Diana. I do have a quick question.
Is that Diana, did you say?
Yes.
Okay, Diana, thank you so much. Go ahead.
For my outpatient list where I refer to, for example, GYN oncology, I don't always have access to their follow-up. So at what point do I stop in my list of treatment? Can I stop at referral?
So you've got I'm not understanding. You've got G1 surgery cases that turned out to be malignant and are being followed up by Jin Onc. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. So it's quite acceptable. First of all, if you did the surgery, I think you mentioned that she's on your office section. If you did the surgery, she has to be on your GYN list. And if she's on your GYN list, no patient can appear twice on your case list. So she cannot be on your office section. Did I misunderstand you there?
Yes, I misspoke. Yes, she is on my GYN list.
GYN. But, okay, that makes more sense.
Yes.
Okay.
Follow-up
okay,
on
so,
the pathology was
cancer. So I under the treatment... The last thing you write under treatment, ongoing follow-up GYN onc, okay? And that's what you do with GYN onc follow-up. Now, let me take an example of... An early stage of cervical cancer. Let's say stage 1B. I'm making it up. You did the surgery. You may have called GYN onc in at the time, and the final histology shows it's, let's say, 2A. I don't know. And the patient was followed up with GYN onc. It's quite acceptable, appropriate for you to write ongoing follow-up GYN onc. But the question becomes, does that mean, which is your question, that you need to know how this patient was followed up? No. If you know it, that's great, and it's nice to be able to share that with the examiner. But it's not like they will penalize you if you don't know what happened to this patient. Now, that being said, it is still reasonable for them to ask you, okay, I understand you may not have followed up extensively with this patient because the GYN onc did so. But tell me, this is the examiner talking to you, tell me, what do you think were the basic principles of treatment that the GYN onc offered this patient? So it's not unreasonable for the examiner to jump from a specific case to a general case. They want to just know, what is your understanding of this kind of clinical scenario? And just by the way, this is not a good example of this, because the amount that they expect us to know as far as ongoing follow-up of cancer is very limited indeed. So you really aren't expected to know much. But let me give you another example. If it's your policy protocol, any patient who comes in with infertility, you do your initial evaluation and then refer them to REI. You can say ongoing follow-up with REI, but it's totally acceptable and legitimate for the examiner to say to you, I understand this patient was followed up with REI, but if you didn't have that REI service available, what's the basic outline you would recommend for this patient? Because it's a fair conversation to have, a basic infertility workup in the general board exam. So, Diane, did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you so much. That was the answer.
You're okay with that?
I was hoping, yes, thank you.
Okay, sure. These are all very good questions, by the way, all of you who volunteered. Emma, Emily, and Diane, thank you so much. Folks, listen, we're almost coming up on 45 minutes, which is how long I like to keep these. Please, folks, it makes a big difference. If you folks, please, will submit cases, questions, concerns that you've got during the week, submit it to the office and let us discuss them. I'm a benign guy, and quite frankly, well, actually, I'm going to ask each of the three of you. Let's start with Emma first. Please be brutally honest. Did you find the interaction helpful and beneficial?
Yes.
Emma? And what about Emily?
Yes.
And Diane?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Yes.
And by the way, folks, thank you, by the way, but in all these three cases, I did much of the talking. It gets really interesting when we get a conversation, a bilateral conversation, two-way conversation going. It is even more meaningful. And by the way, after case list submission, we then go heavy into oral exam technique. And then it's really important to have that two-way interaction. So I'm saying all of this, folks, please, I want you folks, don't be shy. Volunteer to be on the hot seat for the next time. Will be on the 23rd of March. Karina mentioned that to us. And the one thing I unashamedly push this, because it makes a huge difference, if you haven't yet attended our Tasis construction course, which is online, actually we're having one in May live in Baltimore. But I will tell you, folks, since I'm speaking with you in early March, I would tell you, A, unashamedly attend that course. And as much as I would love to see you in person, because it's that much more meaningful, I think the benefit you will get by hearing it now in March online versus waiting till May to hear it in person, it's better to hear it earlier, because it'll change the way you look at your case list. It'll change the way you collect cases. It'll change the way you enter cases onto your list. So please, if you haven't done that, give it some serious thought. And if you have any questions, give the office a call. All right, folks, that's it. Again, our next case, our next teleseminar will be on the 23rd of March. Thank you to Emily, Emma, and Diane. And thanks to everyone else. Please tell your folks, your colleagues to come and join us. This is free. Free is good. And everyone's invited. So thank you to everyone, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Take care. Bye-bye.